Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are enjoying, this is going to be a lit program. I just know it. We have Rick Wilson and Molly Jong Fast on together. Rick Wilson, of course, the author of the New York Times number one best-selling book, Everything Trump Touches Dies. And Molly is the author of many, including two novels, The Normal Girl and The Social Climber's Handbook. Now, Molly, you're not actually a normal girl, though, right? So that's ironic.
It's ironic.
Okay. So, Rick, we have not spoken since I think we were down in Austin, Texas, and your thesis
with our rental car adventures.
We did it. Yeah, that was all right. So, I guess the question is anything changed in your thesis about everything Trump touching dies? Anything at
only,
all?
Passes, it becomes more validated by the inevitable process of destruction for every single human being around this guy. And you know, even the guy we all wanted the rule to not apply to, Jim Mattis, it ended up that it applied to Jim Mattis as well.
So as we're taping this, we get the word that Donald Trump is apparently planning on going to the House of Representatives and delivering the State of the Union address, whether he's invited or not. So I have this image of the president coming down with this phalanx of Secret Service agents being confronting the Capitol Police. What is going on? Where are we at here?
We're in this is the latest iteration, the latest chapter of our national reality TV show. And Donald Trump absolutely loves it. He thrives on it. His entire world is predicated on us bouncing from one moment of chaos and dissension and panic to another. And so he wants a televised showdown with Nancy Pelosi. He wants the Secret Service to be standing there, you know, chest to chest with the Capitol Police, because that would be, in his mind, the sort of professional wrestling as governance that he really, really adores, that he loves. He wants the drama at all times. And he's going to do everything he can to get it.
Okay, I have a quiz, a contest for both of you, and there's a correct answer here. What was the best story of the week so far? The absolute best story of the week, Molly. You want to take a hit at it?
Best
Trump story of the week. Just the most perfect.
Oh, Giuliani.
Trump okay,
absolutely.
Giuliani, there are tapes.
But I shouldn't have mentioned tapes.
Well, I listened to them, but they're not about this.
Right, but these tapes aren't the tapes you're thinking about that we taped. They're
right.
Other tapes.
As
Molly tweeted, Molly Jong Fast tweeted, what could go wrong with tapes, with there being tapes?
Well, tapes worked out very well for Nixon.
Very well for Nixon. And you know what? And it loops back to Jim Comey as well. You know, Lord, I hope there are tapes. Well, buddy, there are tapes.
Okay.
I think that's right.
I'm sorry, Charlie, I think that's the same thing.
The Giuliani meltdown. You know, if you've got a TV lawyer who's a performative lawyer and not an attorney, doing attorney things, you're going to end up with stuff like that with that show this week. And you know, Rudy's my old boss and everything. But this was not a comfortable moment for people that had followed him in the past or worked for him in the past. Yeah, the alumni network was buzzing this week with sort of like, did you see that?
Do we think – I have a question for both of you about the tapes. Which is what do we think the tapes are? Like, I've heard speculation that they're the tapes that Rudy saw that are the Michael Cohen tapes that were seized. But I also think there's a chance that Trump has tapes.
Well, Trump is notorious for putting recording devices in offices and hotel rooms and things like that over the years. We've got some coverage of that over the years. So, but I think it's likely that what Rudy has seen is evidence from the SDNY seizure of Cohen's workplace.
Okay, that's the most plausible. Okay, so you think that was the best story of the week. I'm sorry, you're wrong. You both got it wrong. By far the best story of the week was this report, keeping in mind that the government is shut down and we're facing this national, you know, crisis and the president is mulling, declaring a national emergency. The very best story was the report that his digital team had been enhancing his photos on Facebook, including not just making him thinner, but this is where it becomes just a story for the ages, you know, making his fingers longer.
Yes.
That someone is thinking, what do we need to do today to enhance, you know, our president, you know, the great leader? We need to make his fingers longer. And I keep coming back to this. It's sort of in my head loop, which is that I was never totally sure, Rick, you probably have opinions about this, whether or not Donald Trump had a short finger problem. But obviously he does, and he thinks he does. Otherwise, who would think to elongate his fingers?
This is that moment where the, you know, again, the reality TV thing bumps into that that horrible thing we call reality. Everyone was going to notice it. Everyone was going to see it. In this world, you know, the unsleeping eye of social media is going to spot stuff like that and just make him look ridiculous. I mean, he's done everything now but like stuff a sock down his pants. It's just.
You know. Why do you think he hasn't?
But I think this is a Graydon Carter thing. You know, I think he's still, because remember, Graydon Carter called him a short-fingered vulgarian.
Yeah, it has been in his head. It has been in his head for 30 years now. He hates it. It drives him crazy. And obviously, you know, during the campaign, he had all these completely over-the-top reactions to it, because it is the thing. It is this thing that reflects on him, and he hates any kind of physical imperfection, even though he is a wildly physically imperfect specimen in every way. I mean, no woman wakes up and says, Donald, let me touch your waddle. You know, it just never happens. But this is a president who is a man of overwhelming vanities.
It makes you wonder, though, what he sees when he looks in the mirror. I mean, this is always the question for narcissists. Does he see himself when he looks in the mirror? Does he see the Donald Trump who was in that painting that he had his foundation by? Does he think that's him? You know, it's the self image.
I think there's a part of him that wakes up in the morning and thinks, you know, I am the smartest, tallest, handsomest man in the room. But I also know that there's a part. Sorry, my dogs are.
That's okay. We're dog people here, so this is acceptable.
That's right. As long as it's not the cat.
The cat's like walking around me, making small noises. So she's on the good list right now.
But see, that's why the dog is upset, because the dog is seeing that you are doing things with the cat, right? So you
know, and frankly, the dog is behind a gate right now.
Yeah,
and they can't access the cat or me. So.
You know, that implanted wig, just to like get into brass tacks here for a minute, is, I've heard, experimental, that when it was put in, it was very, you know, it was $30,000, but also experimental.
Right.
So I just think it must look okay to him.
But the whole like weird square head, the whole hairsprayed thing, the entire like dead lemur pelt super glued to his head, it's so creepy. And as a bald dude, I have never in my life heard of a woman who says, your sexy, elaborate 2-hour morning hairdo makes you such a man to me.
It generally doesn't come up saying, you know, you'd look a lot better if you had a comb over or something. It doesn't come up. Okay, so you had a moment, though. We're gonna be airing this the day after we actually are talking here. But you had a moment, Rick, where it did occur to you that is with all the things that we, and I think we generally agree on Donald Trump, that with all of these problems, with all of the implosions, that the Democrats may still work their magic by screwing this up.
Oh, yeah.
And I want both of you to weigh in on this. Yeah.
They have an infinite, for all my woke Democratic friends, they have an infinite capacity to screw the pooch. And there is a real meaningful chance that you're going to end up with somebody as either the nominee or as the spoiler in this thing that is going to end up blowing their chance, a generational chance to make Trump a one-term president.
So who blows it? Who's on that list that you're talking about?
Oh, the top of the list is Bernie. Top of the list is Bernie. You know, you put Bernie Sanders in there, and you're going to end up with, you know, Bernie. You know, Hillary always had problems with firing up the progressive side of the equation. And frankly, she always presumed she would take the same amount of African-American support that Bill did.
Right.
Well, she didn't. With Bernie Sanders, you're going to end up getting like the college prog demo fired up. and they're going to lose 45 states. And it's just the problem of Bernie Sanders is not only that he's not a really particular, he's not a Democrat for one thing, but he's 479 years old. And you know, cranky Uncle Commie is a charming character to have around the dinner table, you know, twice a year at holiday meals, but he's nowhere nearly going to be competitive in the situation going forward.
Okay, so Molly, you're looking at this from the other side of the aisle. Do you agree with Rick's take on all of this? Are you taking the anyone from the menu, or do you agree with this?
So I have a slightly different take. There are a couple of really good candidates. I think there are a bunch of really good candidates. I think that if we have like a really good, I mean, part of what happened with Hillary was she sort of, even though she did really win the nomination, she sort of assumed she was going to have it. So there was no real process there. I think now we have a big field with a lot of really good candidates. And, you know, people like Peter Buttigieg and Sherrod Brown hasn't declared yet, but I think he will run. Like, there are some really great candidates who are progressive in a way that would scratch that itch. I mean, Sherrod is like pretty incredible, and he's doing this whole dignity of work tour. So I think there's a way, I think, at least I hope, that there's a way for Democrats to sort of have their progressive cake and eat it too. I mean, I know that there's a part of the party that is very progressive, but I also think it's our responsibility to really speak to African American voters who have been like the backbone of the Democratic Party forever and ever and ever, and right, who always get the short stick.
Okay, but
always.
Tell me about the Bernie thing, though. I noticed how you sort of sidestepped around that because Rick was laying it down there.
Anytime you mention or tweet about Bernie, your timeline turns into an endless goddamn morass of Bernie bros. I'm not wrong.
But, you know, what I would say about Bernie is Bernie has done some really, really interesting things. And look, you know, if he wins that nomination, you know, then we'll get behind him. But I think we have a real contest here with a lot of really good candidates. And so it'll be interesting to me to see. I mean, there's so many interesting candidates doing weird stuff, and a lot of them aren't even really running for the nomination. They're running to like move the Overton window or to just be in there because they're going to be VPs or they're going to be secretaries. So I think that the Democratic Party will look a lot different after we've gone through this. It's a lot of soul searching, but, you know, Democrats are always, I mean, we're always soul searching.
Okay, you know? let me just give you this, and this thought that's occurred to me over the last couple of days, including Rick's tweet about Bernie being the path for Trump being reelected. You know, there are ways, of course, that the Democrats can manage to do what they did back in 1972, when you had a very unpopular president running for reelection, and they decided to go, you know, with George McGovern, who won what? How many states did he win? I can't even remember now. But it did occur to me over the weekend. I want to get your take on this, Molly, that watching what happened with the Women's March is a pretty good roadmap of how progressives could have a crack up, the kind of crack up that I think the conservative movement has had over the last several years, where the Women's Movement was, you know, the Women's March was a small fraction of what it was before, torn apart by a lot of racial identity politics, anti-Semitism. You were a big supporter of the original Women's March, but you've been outspoken about it more recently. So give me your take on that and the dangers that poses for the left.
I mean, I think that's a really good example. And I actually was I wrote about that a little bit, which was that it is really scary. I mean, what happened there was interesting. I thought what was good was that the DNC was really out in front about disavowing the Women's March. Mm-hmm. And that I thought was very brave. And it showed that there isn't a place for anti-Semitism in the Democratic Party. You know, I always think of the Democratic Party as we're just bigger. You know, we are bigger. And so we have problems of sort of this bigness that Republicans don't have. And we're not quite as ideologically aligned, which is really problematic in certain ways, but is also really great. This was a cautionary tale. I would say the one thing I would say is that a protest march, originally these people had no other venue for activism. You know, Trump had just gotten elected. People were freaking out. You know, marching in the street really spoke to where people were. I don't think that people need to march in the streets right now about this. You know, if he fires Bob Mueller or, you know, he does something insane, we'll march on the streets. But I'm not sure that a march is the best use of energy. So I think there was, and people are, there are just a lot of easier ways to volunteer and get involved. So I'm not sure that the Women's March, I mean, certainly that moment when Tamika Mallory refused to disavow Farrakhan mm-hmm. on The View was like a big moment, because that was the moment that we all were like, if you can't disavow Farrakhan, you can't, there's no, you know, there's no place in the Democratic Party for Louis Farrakhan. Like,
or any party, really.
Right. But I mean, that's not, you know, so, I mean, I think that I was really pleased that Democrats really said no to that, because, you know, in England, that has not been the case.
And look what it's done for the Labour Party. Exactly.
Right.
So
I was impressed that they did that, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, like, people were on it. But yeah, I mean, it's really scary. And there's definitely, there needs to be a sort of connection between the two things. You know, it's scary. I mean, for sure.
All right. So, now, speaking of these, you know, cultural, I want to weigh in on this as well, but I want to get to the Covington kids, because we have to, because it's obligatory to do this. But do you want to weigh in on that, Rick?
You know, I didn't weigh in on the Covington issue when it started, because some little weird bell in my head was like, oh, I smell an outrage mob, and I didn't know how it was going to play through.
We all ought to have that bell in our heads. You know that? We do.
You know, and I did not. And somebody yesterday went at me like, why won't you apologize for attacking? I'm like, because I never did. Because I never said a damn word about it. And you know, and it's one of the problems with the outrage mob culture is now you must take a stand and you must make a statement on every single one of these things. Mm-hmm. And people demand that you, you know, either wear your hair shirt and flagellate yourself, or that you do a victory lap for every single thing, even if you had nothing to do with it or no interest in engaging on that particular front. But I mean, look, I think the Covington issue and the sort of, you know, brouhaha that surrounded it is very, very telling about the current mm-hmm. conservative rage culture. Mm-hmm. And they've taken something that was a, you know, story on the fly in our hyperspeed era of media coverage. And now it's been monetized, and now it's been turned into, you know, a week of programming.
Well, and it's a cudgel for the president. I mean, this is another
correct.
One of his, you know, NFL players, whatever type right. tape issue. And he's going to and he's going to flog it.
Yep. And there's no escaping, you know, the sort of there's no escaping the sort of observation that, you know, conservatism and the Republican Party were once allegedly about, you know, the power, limiting the power of the government and maximizing the power of the individual, and of free markets and of free thinking and of you know, national security and fiscal probity and all these things. And now the thing that lights conservatives up is solely culture war.
Mm-hmm. And portraying themselves as victims. They hate you. They're coming to get you. They're going to mm-hmm. demean your husband, your father, and these kids. And this you know, conservative as victim theme is really what's animating a lot of this.
Oh, did you see that Mitch McConnell talked about this on the floor today?
I did not.
But that seems to me like just in such a like incredible waste of time.
Well, in the White House.
I think the majority leader right now is looking for anything to fill up the day, right. to run out the clock. This is not a happy time in the Senate. His caucus is publicly unified and privately looking at their watches and sort of tapping their feet, going, "How much longer? How much longer?
Yeah,
can't put us through this much longer."
Well, yeah, you know, go ahead.
McConnell says it's families in my home state paying the price for exercising their freedom.
I would just urge people. I have a piece up on The Bulwark, four lessons from all this. The first one actually ought to be read that Ross Douthat column where he talks about the scissor. It's it's a brilliant column on all of this. It's this it's about a fictional algorithm where it's a statement or a scenario that's somehow perfectly calibrated to tear people apart. And once you read it, you go, that really sounds familiar. And this becomes the scissor. But I mean, of all of the lessons, going back to Rick's point about the little bell in your head, to realize these viral videos are the Rashomon of our time. I mean, people see what they want to see. They seize on the details. They confirm their bias. People are shoving these things out, the Brazilian bots, whatever. And you know that you shouldn't react. You just know it, but your thumbs get itchy, and that you want that dopamine hit from getting involved in the fight. But and the worst part about all this, of course, is that people on both sides, and I know that people hate that phrase, want to see this as black and white. Look, these are kids. They are children. Some of them behave badly. Some of them behave well. Reality is ambiguous, and I'm not sure that we can handle that ambiguity anymore. And the worst thing is we cannot continue to make our cultural battles about these children. I mean, they are not cultural icons. They are not leaders. They are just kids,
Yeah.
And whatever the issue is, I mean, they can be sincere, but they could also be arrogant, self-righteous little bastards, and they may not have any idea what they're talking about. There's a reason why we don't let them vote, right?
Right. I'm not sure I would let my kids go to the Lincoln Memorial wearing MAGA hat. I mean, there's a certain, to the March for quote unquote life. Like, there's a certain setup here for this.
I think there is a degree to this where the interaction between a bunch of teenage kids and the black Israelite guys who are weirdly enough, as a guy who grew up in Tampa, they were very active there, and it's a hell of a that's a hell of a Farrakhan-esque style crew, all of its own special flavor. But look, I mean, if I'd been the parents and my kids were at the March for Life or a school chaperone, and you're talking about an event for which Catholics and conservatives take very seriously, I probably would have said, y'all are representing our Catholic school, so let's lose the hats. Right. Let's lose the political hats.
Yep.
Let's, treat this with the dignity of that we're trying and the solemnity we're trying to get here. But look, this entire thing, the outrage mob, everything the right projected about the left for years and years. Oh, you special snowflakes. Oh, you whining babies with your safe spaces. I mean, it has become this thing where the desire to be offended by their betters is so intense and so crazy making that, they will bring this up until the last dog dies as a major skirmish in the culture wars of the early 21st century.
No, that's absolutely right. So I people are going to be wondering now at this point in the podcast, how do you get hooked up with Rick Wilson? How do you guys know each other?
It was love.
I'm just curious.
We've been friends for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I,
I get being friends with you, Molly, but I mean, like, how does it work that? I mean, what are you friends with Rick Wilson? I mean, he used to be this right-wing guy.
I know. He has guns.
So many.
I've never seen a gun, but I mean, I guess I've seen them on police, but I've never held one or anything.
We're going to fix that problem.
Politically we have very different views, but in certain ways we're very similar. So, and we have very similar sense of humor and similar mentality. Yeah. Is that fair?
What do you think? Okay. So you would describe yourself, Molly, as a progressive Democrat.
Yeah.
And Rick, how do you describe yourself these days?
I describe myself as an apostate Republican and conservative till the last.
He's woke.
I describe myself as being faithful. I think everybody else is the apostates.
Look, I it's okay being an apostate throughout history. We end up on the right side of a lot of different questions throughout history. So, I'm just I am comfortable right now with where I am in the political spectrum because, you know, I still believe in the primacy of the individual over the state. I still believe in limiting the power of government over the rights of individuals. I still believe the Constitution is the fundamental operating system of this country. I'm not a statist, and I never will be. And that's Charlie and you and I've talked about this in the past. This is the core difference of Trumpism and why it is so corrosive. And your book was right on point about this. It dissolves the bonds of what conservatism was meant to preserve and protect. It dissolves the idea that conservatism isn't just a tool to say, okay, we're in power now, so we're going to fuck our enemies. Mm-hmm. It was always about restraining impetuous action on the side of any political person in office. It was always about restraining the state from doing things to people, no matter which, you know, Republican or Democrat was in charge of the system.
So, Molly, I'm curious to ask you how you. Yeah, I'm guessing for you, never Trump conservatives are somewhat of an acquired taste.
No, you know, I'm not a person who has to have people agree with me. I don't have that. You know, I don't need people to feel exactly the same way I do about things in order to interact with them, which I think is like a lost art all of a sudden. But I don't need, you know, I can talk to people who have different views and certain things I can always, you know, there's certain things of my views have changed. And, you know, and Trumpism is so different than anything, you know, I think Trumpism is so different that it makes, you know, Democrats and Republicans seem almost the same because we're not pro kleptocracy, you know? But yeah, I mean, I think it doesn't seem like such a huge jump to me, but I also am, you know, I'm very, like, I believe in, you know, I'm pro-choice. I think that there should be a lot of more government programs for, you know, I'm for a minimum basic income. I'm for healthcare for all. I think that we have to rethink a lot of things about training people and tax rates. And I mean, I'm comfortable paying. I mean, it seems our taxes have like continually gone up over Trumpism. So I don't know, you know, I guess we'll pay even higher taxes, but I don't, you know, I believe that the government can and should do certain things for the people.
So you're looking forward to the time when we'll be back to disagreeing about all of that?
Yeah, exactly. The more nuanced. Yeah.
Yeah. When we can actually remember those. You're old enough, Rick, to remember when we actually debated things like education policy and things and paid attention to those things.
And I think that sort of stopped after the 2010 election. And, you know, we got into this point where, you know, statements on the floor were no longer about of the House and the Senate were no longer about a debate or about an issue. They were about how do you generate a hot quote for your email fundraising list.
Mm-hmm.
This was one of those things where, you know, and Ted Cruz, our old buddy Ted Cruz, is one of the leaders of this thing. He wasn't out there on the floor trying to shut the government down because he thought we should shut the government down. He was there because Jeff Rowe and his email team were sending out fundraising blasts timed to coincide with these things. And so we turned debate into a fundraising mechanism, and we turned regular order into this endless patchwork of CRs and spending bills and temporary fixes. And you know, we jumped from one, you know, one dangerous moment to the next in our fiscal lives. Mm-hmm. And so because we've done that, you know, we've eliminated any reason to debate. We know it's not going to accomplish anything. And unfortunately, we stopped fighting about ideas a long time ago. And I think, you know, I think Molly would agree with me on this. Is that we've talked about a lot of things where we have surprising agreements. Mm-hmm. You know, like the tax bill that passed under Trump, you know, both of us know the people it benefited. It's a bunch of goddamn hedge fund guys down on Wall Street. It's not the promised middle class tax, you know, benefit from that bill was de minimis. And so, you know, a lot of these things where people made these sweeping proclamations about how wonderful it was going to be. It ended up having some left and right, you know, cohesion. And I think corruption,
right,
which is what we're seeing now, that is transpartisan. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, that ought to be. No one is above the law. Right.
Right.
If you're not offended by corruption and violations of the law, you know, don't call yourself an American. If but you excuse it for your side in either direction, no, you're not on the same team.
But I also think this tax bill was in certain ways meant to punish the blue states, the states with the higher state tax.
Oh,
so,
sure.
Because of SALT, where it wasn't deductible. So I do think that that kind of like cronyism and that is corruption in its own way.
I was told picking winners and losers was a bad thing.
See, that is so last century, Rick, because all those things. But, you know, going back to your point, we don't debate ideas anymore. I actually was talking with a congressman who was making the same point that, you know, we had been under the assumption that these debates were about ideas and principles, when it really is about attitude and identity and, you know, which tribe you're there. And he was saying that he'd, you know, been invited to I'm not going to give this away, but I mean a prominent young freshman Democratic woman who I won't name, and he said, you know what, I could win the argument, but it would be like bringing a calculator to a knife fight. So let me ask you, in the time we have left yet, how do you think this shutdown is going to end, Molly? I'm going to throw this one to you first. How do you get out of this when this has become a test of the president's manliness?
Somebody's got to go to Ann Coulter. Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh and figure out a deal with them because it's the, you know, he's got 36%. He's worried that that 36% are the Ann Coulter people. So I don't know how he gets out of this.
No, I think that's in part the answer is that we have the president of the United States, who is supposed to be the fighter, the strong man, who's looking over his shoulder. And if Ann Coulter says that he's a wimp, or if Rush Limbaugh thinks that he's being rolled, he's not going to be able to do it. He's painted himself into that corner.
I mean, Rick was brilliant last night about Stephen Miller.
Okay, so be brilliant again. What did you say about Stephen Miller?
Well, I pointed out the serious side of the first off, I made a statement that Stephen Miller would feel better if he finally had sex with a live human woman. But the really convincing
synthetic one. Okay, come on.
You know, science is marching ever forward, Charlie,
exactly,
and I think there's going to come a day
where
Stephen Miller can do what he wants to one of these synthetic female dolls, and it won't be a violation of the law in 49 states. I mean, I feel hopeful technology will get us there. Okay.
Jim Swift, who's our producer, is sitting here and he's gritting his teeth just while he's like, you know, everything else is like he's nodding and it's stuff. It's like, what, you know? You ever see Lars and the Real Girl? I mean, really?
Yeah.
It's just, what is that?
You're torturing Jim.
But here's the more serious note, Charlie. I refer to him as President Miller. Let's remember, the Democrats offered him a $25 billion wall deal in exchange for DACA. And Stephen Miller went absolutely ham, lost his damn mind with everybody, and killed the deal. He stoked up the resentment, caucus, and he got the crazies, you know, whipped into a frenzy, and they killed it. And Stephen Miller has done this repeatedly. And right now, Jared Kushner is trying to negotiate a deal that will give green cards to the DACA kids and green cards to people that are here illegally. And it's going to cause an absolute heart attack among the folks that in the Fox News audience who have been beaten down to believe that anyone brown coming north of the border is an MS-13 gang member coming to rape their children and kill their dog.
Prayer rugs. At the border.
Prayer rugs,
right.
Yeah.
Prayer rugs.
Great moments in journalism.
it really felt like journalism.
So, again, we're not going to be hearing this until a day later, but you guys, I don't know whether you're like checking your phones while we're having this riveting conversation, because I obviously have been. The news just broke a little while ago that Michael Cohen, former Trump consigliere, is delaying his congressional testimony indefinitely, citing ongoing threats against his family, including threats from the president.
Yeah, I saw that in passing while we were having this conversation,
wow.
Charlie. And I think it is I think it is legitimately true that they're suffering under what happens when you stand up against Trump and you get death threats and you get intimidation tactics by these people because you know, this sort of thugocracy around him. But I think Congress should just go ahead and subpoena him at this point.
Well, the thing about it is, and I think you know we've talked about this over the last year and a half, this question of is the president obstructing justice? Of course he is. He's been doing it, you know, slow motion in public over and over again. And to a certain extent, it's amazing how we've been inured to all of this. We've been inured to some of the scandals, what we've learned about his dealings with Russia, what we've learned about the way he's lied about his dealings with Russia, what we've learned about his attempts to intimidate witnesses in this particular case. And because it's Donald Trump, it's like just sort of it's just another day at the White House.
Day in the crazy mind.
Can I just ask a question? Sure. There's no way that Miller is communicating with Jared, right?
I suspect that Miller is communicating with Bill Shine, Ann Coulter, Mark Krikorian, the usual cadre, Bannon, the usual cadre of people in that anti-immigration, you know, don't brown America, the crowd that's around that group. And they certainly have a sort of underground of people. And we know from a lot of the stuff that you know I reported in my book that is the issue that they recognize is the thing that binds together the Fox part of the base, the alt-right part of the base, you know, the grumpy racist part of the base, that is the glue that holds Trump and Trumpism together. Because he's the acceptable sort of avatar for them, and they pretend that it's about illegal aliens and Mexicans, but it's really a much broader sort of racial anxiety in a world that's evolved beyond 1958.
Rick Wilson, we're unfortunately out of time. Rick Wilson and Molly Jong Fast, thank you for joining me on the podcast today. I appreciate it really.
Thank you, Charlie.
Great deal. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.